You are Locked On Heat, your daily Miami Heat podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
All right, let's do this. Welcome to a Wednesday edition of Locked On Heat, your daily Miami Heat podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, the only podcast breaking down every Heat game, news item, rumor, and more. My name is Wes Goldberg. I'm here as always with David Ramil. We are doing part two of our mailbag this week. Part one went up yesterday, where we got a bunch of questions. We talked about whether the Heat are one of the most desperate teams in the NBA. Predictably, David and I disagreed on that. So go check that out if you want to. But let's go to this next question from Recyclops, who writes in, Recyclops, serious about recycling. Recyclops writes in, do you believe Pat Riley has a long-term plan or strategy for this Heat team, or is he reacting to whatever the season slash offseason throws his way? David, this is kind of like getting off to where we ended the last podcast about how desperate the Heat are. Do you think that Pat Riley has a long-term plan here?
I'm going to go with the ultimate cop-out, Wes, somewhere in between. Look, I think that's the reality of almost every team president. I don't think you can have, unless you're Sam Hinkie and the Philadelphia 76ers, it's very, very rare that you will have this kind of five-year plan in place where you see exactly what happens because so much of it changes. Look, a year ago, Jimmy Butler was leading the Minnesota Timberwolves into their first playoff spot in over a decade. Now he wants off the team. He gets traded later on to the Philadelphia 76ers, etc. And we see two different teams change completely. And I think that's the reality. And look, Miami was in that mix too. So I think as far as long-term plans, strategies are concerned, I think there's things that you can count on a short-term basis, probably things that you're looking for, hallmarks that you're looking for benchmarks rather, for your players to reach on a yearly basis. Whether or not you see improvement from Josh Richardson, whether or not you see offensive growth from Justice Winslow, et cetera. And if they reach those benchmarks, then you're a little bit more comfortable as far as what you can do in the long term. But as far as what that's concerned, that changes so much. Paul George was a member of the Indiana Pacers over 2 years ago. Players get traded, major players get traded all the time. And I think from Riley's perspective, you have to retain some sort of flexibility. And if you're going to look at this roster and say that there is a bleak outlook here, it's because some of those contracts have limited what you can do and limited that type of flexibility. Not that they're unmovable. The plan was in 2016 when he signed guys like Olynyk, et cetera, that they could still be moved because they were, relatively small deals, 4 years for 40-ish million dollars, still movable in today's NBA. And still a little bit more flexible, but the players didn't live up to their expectations and kind of hindered that growth and their flexibility, I think, as far as the salary cap is concerned. So I don't see a long-term plan in place. I see kind of a vision, short-term goals, and then a long-term flexibility that you can act whenever an opportunity arises.
I think there was a long-term plan that summer of 2016 that you mentioned there. Was the last 2 years, the last couple off seasons before this one, they had re-signed James Johnson, Dion Waiters. They ended up bringing in Kelly Olynyk. They kind of bring this group in thinking that, okay, either A, these guys are going to develop and we're going to be a really good team in the Eastern Conference, or B, some of these contracts we could package together and make a move for a superstar when Jimmy Butler becomes available, or Paul George, or Kawhi Leonard, or whoever it might be, whatever the next superstar that asks for a trade, we can pounce. That was not the case. I think partly because the salary cap didn't expand the way that Pat Riley and so many teams in the NBA thought that the cap was going to continue to rise, and it just didn't after that big cap spike. I think that hurt them. I think that when you sign Tyler Johnson to $19 million for the last two seasons of his contract, you're thinking that the salary cap is going to be higher than what it ended up being. So I think that got in the way. The Chris Bosh thing. That happened. That got in the way. But there was that plan. I just don't think that the plan has worked out. Not just because of the salary cap, but the players hadn't developed the way they thought. Dion Waiters hasn't been healthy. James Johnson hasn't been healthy. It just hasn't worked out the way that they thought it would. And so you need to switch courses now, right? That plan, that was the plan. The plan didn't work. And now it's time to come up with a new plan. I don't think Riley has that plan yet. I think that Riley is trying to figure out what that plan is going to be. I just don't think he's settled on whatever it's going to be yet. Now, the plan might end up being, okay, we're, you know, 5 to 10 games under 500 going into the new year, or whatever that, if that's the case, let's just tank the rest of the year. That could be a plan. The other plan could be, all right, let's just, nobody wants John Wall. Let's go trade for John Wall. Let's see how that works out. That could be a plan. I just don't know what the plan is right now. And they're a little, they're just kind of in no man's land right now. They're in limbo. Yeah. We're waiting for whatever the next part of the plan is, because this last plan didn't work. And that's fine. It didn't, it was a plan. It didn't work. Time for a new one.
I mean, and you look how much the league has changed. Not even just a team or personnel or even the occasional blip on the radar as far as a big trade is concerned. 10 years ago, Hassan Whiteside would have been the most dominant center in the NBA. He would have been on par with a guy like Dwight Howard, which is bizarre and impossible to even consider, seeing how both of those players have aged out as far as the league is concerned. So it's recognizing what that next big trend is. And I'm not sure that that's clear to anybody, because rules could be changed. They can be tweaked in certain ways. And then all of a sudden the evolution of basketball takes a huge leap up the evolutionary ladder, or just changes altogether. So I don't know that anybody saw a player like Chris Bosh or Draymond Green changing the landscape of the league as completely as they did.
Maybe it's the zone defense. Everybody, make sure to make your way to reddit.com/r/heat on Thursday, December 20th on 2 p.m. Eastern time for our Reddit AMA. It'll be David and I answering any and all questions that you have about the Miami Heat, the podcast, superhero movies, comics, whatever you want to talk about. Again, that's reddit.com/r/heat on Thursday, December 20th, 2 p.m. Eastern time. Ask us whatever you want, and we look forward to chatting with you over there. We've done these in the past. They're always a lot of fun. We'll always have a good time. Awesome. And then you guys always ask some great questions. So that's reddit.com/r/heat, Thursday, December 20th at 2 p.m. Eastern time. We'll see you there. Jonathan asks, has the forced limited rotations actually been beneficial to the team? Jonathan, of course, talking about when guys like Goran Dragic and Hassan Whiteside and these guys are injured, they're missing time. And you've got to, you take this team that has 14 playable guys on it, and you just give Spo fewer options. Do you think it's been helpful?
I think there are two aspects of it that seem beneficial. I think one, obviously, these rotations having been limited, you kind of have to play guys in different roles than they might be used to. Point justice, we might not have seen that as much if not for the fact that Goran's been missing games recently. So I think that's absolutely a great thing. Look, Hassan Whiteside missing a few days for the birth of his first child gives Bam Adebayo the opportunity to start and showcase how much he's grown over the past year and a half. And he's, you know, proven that he was a good choice as far as the draft is concerned. I absolutely love that. And look, I think the other aspect of it is also, I really feel like the Clippers game was a good, example of that. And maybe it was that zone defense as far as, you know, changing things around and throwing Doc Rivers and the Clippers off base a little bit. But there's a kind of back against the wall mentality that I think kicks in for players and realizing that you're down to 8 playable guys on any given night kind of changes your perspective and makes you a little bit more focused, a little bit more desperate, and maybe play with a little bit more intensity. And we saw that in a very big win against the Clippers, who at that point in time were, what, the second best team in the Western Conference? Mm-hmm. Obviously, that can change on a daily basis, but I think there's something to be said for that. You look at even way, way back when the 72-10 Chicago Bulls came to Miami, and there was a team that had been decimated by a trade, and they were able to be one of those 10 teams that knocked off the Bulls that season, beating Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen, Dennis Rodman, etc. Now, you could say that was the South Beach effect, as many people have in the past, but at the same time, a team led by Rex Chapman and Tony Smith and all these scrub players at that point in time were able to knock off a team that eventually set the record as far as most overall wins and was one of the best teams in NBA history. So I think that desperation certainly is a motivating factor for guys.
Rex Chapman, shout out on the pod. Didn't expect that coming. look, I think it helps when certain guys are out, right? If this is a good question, but it needs a nuanced approach. It doesn't help when Goran Dragic is out. Now, you're right. It forces Spoelstra to play Justice Winslow at point guard, and there's positives there from a developmental standpoint, but the team is better when Dragic is on the floor. And so if we're looking at this through the lens of just winning games, which I think is the spirit of the question here, no, it doesn't help. But when a guy like James Johnson or Hassan Whiteside or Tyler Johnson misses games, those three guys specifically, I think it helps because you're not forced to play Dyle Johnson off the bench. You can give some minutes to other guys. Wayne Ellington missing time hasn't helped because of what he could do as a floor spacer, even though he's been pretty bad defensively this year. Whiteside missing time, it's no secret. He's not the best center on the roster. Get the best center on the roster on the floor more often right away. That helps the team. And then James Johnson, I really think that he should have probably started. I don't think he should have been in the rotation right away. I'd really like to see some of these teams use their G League affiliate as, like baseball does, just getting guys back onto the floor, conditioned into, you know, to until you're ready to play at the NBA level. James Johnson is just sort of like playing his way into shape on the floor. I think that's hurting Miami.
Especially in the G League where the pace is so furious because all these guys are trying to put up as many shots as possible. So the pace across the board in the G League is so much faster even than the league. His conditioning would have been at a much higher level, especially in Sioux Falls where they take pride in that kind of thing. So it would have been very, very good for him to get that working.
Yeah, and I think, you know, with him playing his way on the shape, it just has hurt the team, you know? And I just think that and there's better front court combinations that the Heat can go to, specifically Bam and Kelly Olynyk together. So, I think
Spo might have been a little desperate, maybe, and that's why you kind of rushed James back in there.
I thought that it seemed like they were really patient with James Johnson. I just think that there's a stigma right now at the G League because it's a newer development, right? I mentioned the baseball thing. The AAA has been there for forever. I think that there's a stigma for a vet like James Johnson who's played well at the highest level to play even a little bit in the G League would be kind of a negative connotation.
He's played in the D League back in the day, didn't he?
And he probably doesn't want to, he's like, I ain't going back. But like, it's just, I think that stigma, they need to shed that stigma. I think they need to use it for development. Yes. And they are doing a good job of that. They being the NBA in general right now, they also need to use it for rehab and for getting guys involved. I'm actually really interested to see what the Warriors do with DeMarcus Cousins to see if they get, he's practiced in Santa Cruz a little bit. It'll be interesting to see if he plays in Santa Cruz, their G League affiliate, a little bit. But it'll be interesting to see. That team's so light years ahead, maybe they'll be the first one to do it. Speaking of light years ahead, let's get to this next question from Billy, who writes in, Moneyball! Pat Riley needs to watch the movie, so he learns not to give out bloated contracts to average players. Anyways, in the movie, on-base percentage was the big number they looked at when determining the value of their players. What would the Moneyball stat for basketball be? Also, which Heat players would you keep based off of these stats when their contracts expire? So, David, two-part question. Let's answer the first part. What would the Moneyball stat for basketball be? I think we're already sort of seeing the Moneyball era of basketball happen, especially when you go and look at that team in Houston.
That's a fair point.
Yeah, with percentage of shots at the rim, percentage of shots from three-point range. That tends to be the Moneyball stat. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, true shooting percentage. Yeah. I mean, I guess if you had to limit it, I mean, that seems like the one determining factor as far as overall efficiency of your shot, et cetera. And it weighs the 3-point shot differently. So I think that certainly would be a considering factor. I'm curious to see whether or not things like assist rate might be like depending on the overall kind of makeup of your team, whether or not you want five playmakers across the board, whether or not you might give some consideration to that as far as being able to make plays at every position as opposed to having a guy like Whiteside who doesn't necessarily make plays for the rest of his teammates.
Like assist ratio, you mean? Like
Sorry, what did I say?
I wasn't sure what you said.
Okay.
So like assist ratio where you're judging, okay, the rate of assists versus not turning the ball over and giving up easy points in transition. I like that one. I kind of have something similar. I was almost thinking like, I know we've got efficient field goal percentage and true shooting percentage. I think it was JB Bickerstaff recently who said, when asked about mid-range shots, right? Said, I'd rather just see the ball go through the hoop 6 times out of 12 as opposed to 4 times out of 12 or whatever I'm paraphrasing here. Because at least I know I can be set on defense. That was a really interesting thing, and I started thinking about that a lot more afterwards. There's a lot of truth to that, and that would be, by the way, field goal percentage. Just like that, the raw field goal percentage number that we've been using for years and before all the true shooting percentages and stuff like that, just field goal percentage. How many shots did you make out of how many you attempted? If you are a team, and you made a good point, it depends on what kind of team you're constructing. If you're a team that struggles to get out and defend in transition, field goal percentage might be way more important than true shooting percentage to you. You might, because you don't want, because true shooting percentage, that weighs, you know, the fact that three-pointers are worth one more point than two-pointers. Well, you might be making a three, but then giving up 2 points on the other end. So you're really only getting 1 point, where if you're hitting a mid-range shot, the ball goes to the net, you can get set on defense, and you're able to get a stop. Well, now that's a net 2 point gain versus a net 1 point gain, even though you made a three on the other end. And I think that needs to be considered here. So it really does depend on what kind of team you're putting together. Because if you're the Heat and you've struggled in transition, you know, for the beginning of the season, they've gotten a little bit better since then. But if you're a team that struggles in transition defense, you might just say, let's just get the ball to go through the net so that we can get set.
Now, the hole in Bickerstaff's argument there is, if you're taking threes, aren't you already further back to help set your defense up to prevent a shot at the opposing rim? Like, if you take a three-point shot, you're already 22 and a half feet closer, or 23
well, one
feet,
guy is.
Whatever the distance might be. Yeah, well, I mean, that's the whole thing. Yeah. It's most teams devalue the rebound, etc. So I still feel like that, like, you're not giving up much more on defense. Like, I don't know if that's quantified. I'm sure probably our friends over at Nylon Calculus have figured out how much mileage is lost per season as far as, you know, whether or not you defend three-pointers or two-pointers at the rim.
It'll be interesting. I kind of want to look at this, and I haven't gotten the opportunity to do it, but to look at, you know, the teams that average the most three-point attempts per game versus the teams that give up the most points in transition, and to see if there's a Venn diagram, like, if there's what the middle part of that Venn diagram looks like.
That's fair. Let me look at the Warriors shoot a high percentage of three-pointers as far as making them, but they don't shoot a lot as far as
they take a bunch of mid-range shots this year. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. But overall, it seems like, to go back to this question here, the league has sort of agreed at this point that the Moneyball stat is percentage at the rim, percentage from the three-point line and beyond, and that's sort of your Moneyball stat. What Heat players would you keep based off of this? I mean, I think the obvious thing would be none of them, based on the fact that nobody can hit shots at the rim. Like, I think you would keep the guys that have the potential to do that. Josh Richardson, Justice Winslow, Bam Adebayo, Kelly Olynyk, his ability to space the floor from the five, Wayne Ellington, obviously. When the contracts expire, I'm assuming we're not worrying about the salary cap. This is more of a hypothetical. Rodney Magruder, probably, you know, he's a nice catch and shoot option, even though he's not done as much of it this year. I think he's got the capability. That's probably it. I'm trying to think.
It's a tough roster as far as any kind of money ball scenario.
This is the anti money ball team is the Miami Heat almost.
Well, it's strange considering the fact that there are younger, more analytically bent people on the front, in the front office, specifically Shane Battier and Nick Harrison and things of that sort. So you wonder whether or not that's going to change in the future. I think from a guy like Riley, who kind of, I don't know that he necessarily puts a lot of weight in the analytics. I think it's more about seeing the on-court performance.
Well, he's put people around him that care. So that lends, I feel like he does care a little bit, even though he's kind of like saying, like, I don't get it, but it seems like everybody else gets it, so let me hire a guy like Shane Battier, who has, like, even as a player, talked about how much he loved the analytics part of things.
Chris Kaman, man. Yeah, gotta go back to Chris Kaman.
All right, well, that's all we have for today. Thanks for listening. Be sure to subscribe to Locked On Heat on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or whatever you use to listen to podcasts. And leave us a rating or review while you're there. Connect on Twitter at Locked On Heat or email us at LockedOnHeat@gmail.com. Don't forget to tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On Heat if you don't want to use any buttons to listen to us. And we'll catch you next time. Thanks for joining me, David.
You got it, Wes.